There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, everyone. It's Helen here, the voice of Azu, Enola, and Laverne. Today, I'm here to tell you about Woe Begone, a podcast launched on the RQ Network. Woe Begone is a weekly horror sci-fi audio drama series about the nature of power and the implications of linear time. Woe Begone follows Mike Walters, who discovers a mysterious and violent online game. What begins as an exploration of an alternate reality game with real-life consequences quickly becomes a search for the technology that makes the game possible. Each episode has a unique soundtrack composed by creator and writer Dylan Griggs. Listen to Woe Begone, spelled Woe period Begone, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out woebegonepod.com for episodes and transcripts. Have fun! And see you later.
Hi everyone, Ben here. I'd just like to take a moment to thank some of our patrons. Rob Sheridan, Andrew Bushell, Quentin Walker, Dylan Parkhurst, Linda Jean, Neon Grey, Holly Aitchinson, Andrea Rourke, Bat Momar, John Dondereau. Thank you all. We really appreciate your support. If you'd like to join them, go to www.patreon.com/rustyquill and take a look at our rewards.
Rusty Quill presents
The Magnus Archives.
Right. Hello and welcome to our assistant special of the Magnus Archives. We're in our season break at the moment and we thought we would take the time and catch up with some of the assistants for the archive because we all listen to a certain Jonathan Sims rather a lot on Magnus Archives. Yeah. So I thought we might spend some time with people other than Johnny. With that in mind, who have I got with me today?
We got Mike, who plays Tim Stoker.
And Lydia, who plays Melanie.
So first things first then, obviously you play Tim, Mike, you play Melanie, Lydia,
well done. Yep.
And I play Martin.
Solid yep. Remembering.
Good job there.
So what do you actually think about your own characters?
Oh, I knew the heavy stuff was going to come out first.
No.
I'm happy to lead the charge and say, whilst Martin's lovely, I think he'd drive me completely up the wall. I think I'd be like, no, you're lovely, stop. Just go. Go visit pets at home and stroke some animals for yeah. Martin and you'll feel better. But for the rest of you, what are your actual takeaways of the characters that you play?
Well, go on then, I'll go next. So my character, I've always found, well, since season two, I've found a bit of a struggle. Mostly because he started off very happy-go-lucky and sort of, you know, very lively, very chipper, and then am I allowed to give spoilers?
Yeah, you are, yeah.
Amazing. Well, towards the end of season two, everything kind of goes to pot and Tim becomes horrendously depressed to the point where my character was the polar opposite of what I was originally brought on to do.
It's a bait and switch, really.
Yeah, it literally was the best bait and switch.
It worked really well.
Don't get me wrong, I enjoy it. I do really enjoy it. It gives me a moment of quiet contemplation so I can consider my life decisions at least once a month. But, like, at the same time, if I were to meet Tim, I'd just slap him. I'd fall backhand as well, pimpering everything.
He's had a rough time of it.
He's had a very rough time of it.
He's had a very rough time of it.
But come on.
But look at his support network.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Lack thereof.
Lack thereof, yeah. I think that that is the main problem, is that there is no predefined support network for Tim. He needs, like, something to pull him out.
Anyone.
And after that happens, if that happens, things will probably get better for Tim. But hey, we'll have to see.
It's a horror podcast. I'm sure that getting a wonderful support network and the tools to work through his traumas and lots of hugs and puppies is exactly what's going to happen.
Well, the thing is, they'll be readily available, but never accessible.
Tantalus's support network.
Well, that's still brighter than how I was thinking. The tools to deal with your problems in the Magnus universe generally consist of some kind of book or like a gun or a knife or fire. Fire's a good one.
Yeah.
Being oblivious seems to be the only power.
You know what? So far, being completely oblivious, there's your solution.
Yeah.
How about you, Lydia? Playing Melanie, how have you been finding it? What do you think of your character?
I still want to know why and how she was shot by a ghost.
I want to know that.
I don't know. Right? That
none of us do.
None of us
genuinely
do.
The
that
only person
Johnny
who
will not, well, he won't tell me.
The only person who knows is Johnny, and he has abjectly refused to tell us.
It's a little frustrating.
only a major defining character moment that drove you back towards the Magnus archives.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like you need to know what your motivations are.
Yeah. Right, so I started out, obviously I started later than you two, and she came in, I thought it was probably going to be for a one-off early on, and the only characteristic that I gave her really was that it was, you know, how far is the rod up her ass on any particular given day. And since then, I've sort of developed that into, well, it's very important to her that she seems competent, and she seems to lash out the moment that she doesn't really know what's going on, or that she thinks other people think she doesn't know what's going on. And so, yeah, that's the one way you could hurt her the most. It's probably like, yeah, I think probably her ideal torch would be something like the spiral, where it's like she's given a test and she hasn't studied for it.
Or potentially like IKEA furniture, when she's the only one and doesn't have a handbook.
Or like the Allen key doesn't quite fit.
Yeah.
But there's other people doing it who do have all the bits and are doing really well.
And it's fine.
And everything's okay.
And they keep offering to help.
Yeah.
If I wanted help, I'd ask for it.
Exactly.
Non-branded he man / green thing smash, right?
Smash anger, yes.
Smash anger.
So she's still got some cheer in her, which is ridiculous. I think the last time that I played her, she was inviting Martin to the pub.
Yes!
So there's actually some happiness, which is obviously a cruelty.
Playing the characters. So obviously we know like what you think about them and stuff like that. But when it comes to actually playing the characters, obviously like for all of us, these aren't us. Like, they're really, really not us as people.
I mean, like, Tumblr, you would have absolutely no sympathy with Alex in real life.
I'm horrible.
He's awful. No kittens for Alex.
But in all seriousness, obviously, like, you have to have an in. You have to have an in for your character. You have to have a way to get in and actually, like, portray that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, because, Mike, starting with you, you've had the most change. Mm. Because you're in initially, when we were sort of going over character stuff, was very much that positivity, and it was that it was almost like if the Magnus Archives needed to have a PR face, like it'd be Mike, you know, come join the Magnus Archives.
Yeah, the person who
got books,
who does the finger guns and everything, points, and you know, we just look at our merch. We've got merch. Have you heard about the merch?
And most of the characterization for that just consisted of reining it in a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Now that's kind of gone. So what's your in now? Because I'd actually say that you're getting really good at just switching as a character, Tim, on and off.
Well, I mean, this is a horror podcast, but I feel like I'm going to bring the tone down now. So basically, in the season one stuff, like you say, it was very easy for me, because my character outside of the character is very, I feel it's very lively and bubbly. And if you saw the Christmas live stream, then that basically is who we are as, you know, as people. And having to make that switch around season two was very, very difficult.
That was tough.
To the beginning, for the beginning of it, literally, you know, you guys probably don't know who are listening, but we have show notes in the middle and at the end of everything that we do. And Alex sits through and takes us through a couple of his thoughts, and we discuss ideas about how we could have played that scene differently or better or whatever.
It's almost like respecting your actors, but not.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Almost like giving a helping hand, but with the helping hand is also a whoopee cushion. So what we ended up doing, Alex and I, during the beginning few times, was that we'd sit down and Alex would be like, you have to be less of that.
I think less fun.
Yeah.
I think you were thrown by just how hard a change the character had to go
massively
through, because at first it was very much like, okay, so you want it still to be sort of like Tim, just maybe a little bit sedate. He's like, no, this is like
broken,
completely
individual.
Broken. There is nothing left.
No hope left about anything. And that in the beginning was very difficult. But now, if going back to the original question, my in to getting there is actually to think about everything in my life that has gone wrong. All at once.
Yeah, pretty much.
And then that is how I hit the tone of Tim when I come into the recording studio.
But that makes sense, because, I mean, from Tim, like, the way we were discussing it as a character was, like, we only really started making progress and we realised it was best to just, you are not playing Tim anymore.
No.
You're playing another person who is still called Tim, almost, like, because it was just,
yeah.
We had to take it right back down to zero.
I mean, like you said, it's very much a case of we had to go back beyond zero, I feel, to kind of get to where I am with Tim now, because I have to remove everything from my mind that was what Tim was in season one and know that that character is still there underneath everything else.
Sure. I mean, as someone that listens, it feels like there's still like the shape of the character there, because it's coming out now in very dry humour.
Yeah.
And what's sort of clever about it is it's not an empowered dry humour. It's not a I'm laughing at what's happening to me yet. It's a really bitter dry humour.
Lydia, playing Melanie, what's your in? Because again, I think we had a harder time with it at the start, but you've gotten really good similarly at just sort of adopting that persona now.
So I am not a voice actor. I've done quite a lot of recorded stuff, but it's always been me doing the work. Yeah. And I really struggle with a lot of kinds of performing, because I essentially don't have a poker face, and I've worked quite hard on a lot of things like improv skills and presentation skills. So,
like, you're a very skilled speaker.
Yeah.
So
that's things that I do as me. And so it's actually quite strange. I haven't actually acted as another character in terms of like how the character themselves is. I tend to think of, like, is she doing work that she's proud of right now? So in the first thing, where they're in the old hospital,
the frustration
is her job didn't work.
Yes.
And she doesn't understand why.
Yeah.
And so that's almost more of a problem than the fear.
Mm.
I saw this thing and I don't have the answer. Whereas, like, she's the producer, right? Like, her whole character is that she's a producer.
Mm.
She makes stuff happen and she makes stuff work and she knows people and she gets things to... and then in quite a few other things, like, all the things that have happened since, there was something spun out. Like, where she went and broke into that train carriage, it's all very planned.
She's
a producer. She works out how to do it. I had to go there. There was a lot of security, but I found a way in.
Yeah.
And then it all spirals out of control, and so this is horrible for her. So that's why I actually think that she quite enjoyed the time that she read the statement of the guy in the bed, because there she's doing her job, and at the end she's going through all the files and it's just like, well, this is a working day. And you know, similar, I'm not going to spoil it too specifically, but you know, there's a lot of things where there's like, okay, here's a terrible threat to you, that someone's made a horrible threat. What's the obvious solution?
Yes.
Take out the threat. Like, I actually was a bit annoyed that it was done so clumsily. But
we did have a big discussion about, well, I mean, if I was Melanie, which I sort of am, I'd have done it a lot better, because I happen to know that what she's using wouldn't really work in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I sort of, you know, you think, well, she's under a lot of pressure. but yeah, so that's why I think that, you know, it makes sense for her to click with Basira.
So yeah, when it comes to playing Martin, there's a bit of a weird juxtaposition there, because on the one hand, I'd argue that he's been used earlier for a lot of the comedy. Like, again, he's a foil. He's a foil to the dour archivist. But on the flip side, that isn't enough for a character. So it meant that we've had to sort of dial up things other than just, oh, wacka, 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 how inept. But part of that means that when it comes to playing Martin, I basically looked back, picked all of the things about myself that I left by the wayside in a younger version, and then just make that the entire person.
Oh, mate.
No, genuinely. Oh, like, this is an insight into all of the worst bits of Alex about 10 years ago. But obviously the caring thing, I mean, that's a weakness, obviously. Caring is a weakness. But I just mean like that nervousness, that like obsession with trying to make things work and so on. Like, I basically just hunted down a bunch of negative characteristics. Like,
yeah, it's true that needing to fix everyone is definitely something that you...
Oh, it's something that I...
It's so common. And then you do genuinely have to kind of... Like, sometimes you just be like, yeah, Martin, not everyone will like you all of the time. Yeah, and that's okay.
Martin's
that's okay.
Very much an 18-year-old.
Oh.
Like, that's what Martin... Like, I realise the character is not
that. A good 18-year-old.
But you know what I mean?
Such a good 18-year-old.
But it is an 18-year-old where someone older comes along and goes, listen, one, people are going to hate you.
Yeah.
Two, that's okay.
Yeah.
And three, you can't fix everyone.
Yeah. No, exactly, yeah. And he has the best of intentions,
but,
right?
Yeah, that's, but... so I, like, that's me just hunting down for all of the hard lessons.
I just want to give him a hug.
He doesn't need a hug. He needs to grow up. I did it, so can he.
Genuinely, when I listen to Martin on the Magnus Archives, I just want to give him a hug.
Yeah.
And then I have to come in and play a character that snubs him constantly. And I'm just like, but I like you. But I'm obliged to hate you.
Contractually obliged to be
the narrative gods require me to ruin your life. Okay.
Is so, that what you want us to call you now?
The narrative
gods. You and
gods.
Johnny.
Oh, well, I didn't say it. Wait, I did.
You kind of did. It's on, it's on
you did,
everything
we've
now.
We've got evidence.
Yeah.
Twice. So... what were your favourite character moments then? So we've been sort of discussing a few specific examples. In any type, whether it was horror, just good acting, funny, whatever, for your character specifically, what would you say are the bits that you actually, like, really enjoyed? Because certainly from my perspective, I find it really hard to do that. Because for me, it's always, I'm looking at the work, so I'm sat there going, oh, I could have done that. Oh, I probably should have tweaked that. Oh, I could have improved that. So I found it quite difficult to home in on, I really enjoyed this.
No, I hated all of it.
Fair.
Terrible. Terrible
and
experience. Wouldn't do it again.
Cut there, yeah. That'll do, right. We're done, yeah?
Off the chips.
Yay. Oh, production meals. Well, we started with me a few times. Do you want to go first, Luke?
I'm happy to go first if you
want. I was going to say
you go first.
Sure, sure.
All right, go on, Alex.
So there were a few of mine that I liked. I liked doing Dig. Because doing the statements is a nice moment where you can kind of lay aside the character that you normally play and play sort of someone else. And I've especially been enjoying them recently because it's almost like I'm not doing the statement. I'm doing an impression of how Johnny would perform the statement.
Right. Yeah, I see what you mean.
So there's an added layer to that, which makes it quite fun and quite interesting. Mm-hmm. From a comedy perspective, I know a lot of people, it's cringe humour, and I personally hate cringe humour.
Oh, no.
Trying to pay the statement giver was improvised. So whilst the statement, like, we had a couple of bullet points to hit, and one of them was that she's under the impression that she's going to get paid, but pulling out money and paying for it was just off the cuff. And that entire take that we finally used was basically Lowry desperately trying to not react out of character as she's crying with laughter, suppressing it, because it came from, like, completely left field. So that was good fun because we got a great take, but literally on the other side of the microphone is I have her biting her lips desperately trying not to laugh. So it was quite nice. I enjoyed that.
I can't wait if there's offcuts of that. I really cannot wait.
I did enjoy that a lot.
So my favorite would be, I can't even remember which episode it was, but the first time I came in and had an argument with Johnny on.
Yes.
So at that point, you were still quite early on in recording.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
we were still recording on a blanket.
Yeah. And the fact that, so me and Johnny have known each other 10 years. And from the beginning, that was through comedy theatre at university. And, like, we just could not keep a straight face. Yeah. I think it took
took a long time.
To like well over an hour,
it took
I think.
A long time for like 5 minutes or
yeah.
I can believe it.
But that I mean that actually means that the energy in the thing is two people that are frustrated and are really wound
because
up.
You're on take 30.
And that's because like we're both looking at each other, daring each other to crack up. I think there was like by the end of it, there was just like the complex web of in jokes about the fact because the light on the corridor as well. So the backstory as well, right? So we were recording under a blanket in Martin and Sarah's corridor, and the light in the hallway was
a disco light.
Yeah. So you're under a blanket shouting at each other, and then you take it off while Alex is reviewing the sound and working out how to direct your next take, and you're like, and then you just start dancing. Then you put the blanket back on and you're shouting at each other and trying to wind each other up in as different characters while also winding each other up as real people.
It's a total roller coaster ride.
It was brilliant.
I don't miss the disco corridor.
I really miss the disco corridor.
Yeah.
I loved that corridor.
Dance party.
Yeah, all the time, every take.
So, what was yours then,
hit
Mike?
What was your
favourite moments, Ben?
There are a few that stick out. I think one of my favourite scenes to shoot was the one where Martin and Tim. And the backstory to this was that the recording that we were doing at that point was in the corner of a room. And so it was Martin and Tim running away from not Sasha and then having to run down corridors, Bunny is, and then pant and be out of breath.
We did so
literally,
many takes.
Me, Alex, and I were stood in a corner for about 8 takes, literally
Chugging
just going. And that was before we set the audio running so that we would actually be out of breath by the time we got to shooting.
That's the thing, is everyone likes the exciting episodes, you know, where a lot happens as a way of breaking it up. I cannot stress enough, there is no better way to feel like a complete than pretending to have fights or pretending to run. Like, God, recording combat's the worst.
Exactly.
It makes you feel such an idiot.
But I'll tell you what, it was flipping good fun.
Sprinting at a wall over and over again.
And we were actually jogging on the spot as well, like, to try and get ourselves in the mind of the character.
It's nonsense.
The production level, like quality level on the Magnus and gaming, I can say it's absurdly high because I don't do any of the work. Like, it's Alex and his team of extraordinary editors that do that. But it means that, like, the stuff that they end up demanding of us in order to produce the right foley or the right kind of attitude or the right, like, you get some very bizarre asks.
Finishing up then with the last bit of like what is your relationship with horror? So you as a person, not your characters, let's not get like really meta with it or anything, but for each of you, how are you engaging with horror? How are you interacting with it? Even if it's just I hate horror, which I don't think is the case for either of you, but nonetheless, like how do you engage with it as a genre?
So I have no interest in being upset, scared by media.
Sure.
But I have a long relationship with horror as a thing to make and a thing that has an interesting kind of commentary on the world.
Yeah.
But like we were talking earlier actually today about like the British horror tradition, which from Vertigo and Alan Moore and Karen Berger, which I see the Magnus Archives as being like it fits very nicely within that tradition because it's a very politically aware, clever psychological horror. That is of its time and reflects kind of ideas and fears of the current kind of era. So we were talking earlier about like the arc of Swamp Thing where it starts out B-movie type.
Guy turns into a compost heap.
Guy turns into a compost heap. Yeah, guy and his wife are in a place. They get blown up and the wife dies because motivation, that's what we're good for. Guy turns into a compost heap and then wants to like avenge her because that's where we are. And like it's pretty B-movie. It's a good B-movie, but then Alan Moore comes in and it changes. Like, there's this incredible kind of shift as it becomes about identity and bodies and psychology and your real connection to the earth. And it has all those weird LSD sex scenes.
See, for that specifically, I was always fascinated with, because it was Alan Moore that really dove into it, the whole he's fine unless you're afraid, and then the fear like hurts, so then he gets like aggressive. Like, that's that was a lovely way of exploring a lot of stuff.
Absolutely.
Because, shocker, people who work on the Magnus Archives are interested in the fear and fear as a mechanism and etc.
A little bit.
I feel like.
So yeah, I love horror as a mechanism to talk about interesting, scary things.
It's a good lens.
Yeah, but I've got absolutely no interest in watching horror films and getting freaked out.
You know, I find that really interesting, actually, because coming on board with the Magnus Archives was a massive step change for me.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about all the awesome writers that you guys know about, and I'm sort of starting to learn about it because I'm interested. You know, and I'm interested in Johnny's motivations and Alex and Lyd's motivations and all the other guys on the cast as well. And for me, I used to deal with comedy. You know, my YouTube channel was a comedy channel, and coming into the Magnus Archives and then editing it and, you know, playing a character in it was just the polar opposite of everything that I'd ever known or was used to. Because like you, Lydia, there is some horror that I enjoy watching, but I don't really enjoy being scared, inverted commas, by media and what have you. You know, there's enough of that in the world already. So I'm very much of the opinion that I prefer things that aren't horror. So then playing a character in a horror podcast for me gives me that perspective of what would happen if someone came in and they didn't have the first idea about any of this lore or, you know. I mean, obviously I know about things like the Eldritch Horror. I mean, you know, that. You know, I'm familiar with it. I've listened to a few of the audiobooks now. That was introduced to me by a friend of mine and his brother. That was my entry into a lot of the things that I think you guys have been thinking about for a while, and some of the sort of stuff that's sitting in the background. And I'm actually learning about this stuff as I'm going through playing the character, listening to the stories, listening back to everyone's work. And that's where I pitch in.
See, I'm a bit of a weird one when it comes to horror. So, shocker, teenage boy likes horror. Stop the presses. How weird I was.
I know, this has never happened before, literally ever.
So I was, shocker, I was a little bit of an obsessive kid in certain ways. And one of them is, if you introduce me to an author, I'll read every single thing they ever read, and then I'll move on to the next author, and then read every single thing they ever read, and move on, and so on.
Yeah.
But for me with horror, I'm a little bit broken in that I've genuinely never found any piece of horror media that's really, or very rarely at least, found anything that actually hasn't affect on me. Like, I don't get that kind of emotional response. It just doesn't really work for me.
Yeah.
But I've engaged with horror a lot, both like writing myself or in making, like, it's been a while, like film and so on. But I'd say my main in has been sort of cinema and so on. But for a lot of it, it comes down to horror is an excellent technical example for working in fiction.
Because
there's a reason that if you are starting a new production company or you're trying to break into film, almost everyone makes horror. And there's a reason for it. And it's that it has a lot of very, very clearly codified tropes, trend, and techniques. You know, if you want to do horror, is your character feeling psychologically unbalanced? Chuck in a Dutch angle in there, rotate the camera by about, you know, 25 degrees, and then maybe do a tilt shift to mess around with like some distances and so on. But I think horror is one of the genres more than any other where it allows technique to shine.
Absolutely.
Because if you are bad, it does not matter how good your monster is or how good your conceit is, your thing will be garbage.
Yeah, exactly. It's
peculiar in that everyone always goes to horror because they know horror best, but it's also in a lot of ways the least forgiving.
I think comedy and horror actually have quite a lot in common. In that they're all about you have to be playing with the audience's energy. Like, you have to be exactly aware of where they are on any kind of arc to break the tension at exactly the right point. So I think the fact that most of us of the wider team knew each other through comedy and were trained in comedy, like, comedy is the hardest thing to do well, and to do really well. And that means that you And I think in many ways you have to lose your ego to be good at it, because you have to be willing to mess up in the most embarrassing ways.
Yeah. Like yeah, yeah.
Your first 105 minutes on an open mic night are going to be horrendous.
Mm. Yeah.
And that allows you to then play with energy and timing.
We've got to draw to a close. I think we've had a lot of discussion. I know we'd like to go into stuff in some more detail, but, you know, time is a thing that we have to factor. Yeah.
No! Neither that nor space!
Does this mean part two?
So, what I would ask then is, what if you had to recommend one piece of horror for listeners, not necessarily like, you love the Magnus Archives, so you will like this, but something more like, if you want to know horror, you should try this.
I think already this podcast, but reading that early Vertigo stuff, that British psychological horror twist, and there's only you probably only need to get through a bunch of, like, you know, maybe 100 rather short comics. It can be read in a relatively short period of time, and you begin to see this. You see this whole world change, and I think it's a really interesting direction shift that changed a lot of horror that came after it. But I'm not an expert, so it could well be that other people be like, no, this other writer came well before. But reading through the early Swamp Thing and then how that exploded into Sandman and Hellblazer and a lot of other like related characters was super valuable to me.
How about you, Mike?
So from the way that I've engaged with horror, I guess, there are, like Lydia said, there are lots of different styles and there are lots of different elements. But if you want a pure, in my opinion, kind of perspective on different kinds of horror that exist within one place or one universe or one thing, Alien Isolation is a fantastic way to get into it, because having a think about other gaming titles, there are a lot of gaming titles like Dead Space and things like that, which give you weaponry to be able to deal with whatever threat is coming after you. It's horror, but it's a once removed kind of, because you know that the threat is always at arm's reach if you need it to be, unless that's taken away from you. And in Alien Isolation, it is. There is a constant threat and it will never go away, and it follows you throughout the entire game.
I'm genuinely too terrified by the very concept to think about picking it up.
It's an excellent examination of tension.
Yeah, well, not just tension, though. I'd say it's more than that. Building on your point is that it's tension, but it's also the subjugation of an individual within a tense environment. And there are points where you have weaponry, but you still can't do anything to get rid of the main threat. So, you know, and then there are other elements as well, like, you know, stealth bits and, you know, there's things in there.
Well, it's a really good example of taking those important bits that we think in like Western horror, especially in horror sci-fi, obviously. But because it has to turn them into mechanics, it highlights them in a really interesting way. So it does, like, if you go into it with a critical eye, like trying to like engage yourself and learn, you can learn a lot just by playing that game, by going, oh, I see what you're doing with the music. Look at how you've set this space out to focus on.
It's
a good demonstration if you choose to interpret it that way.
And do you know what, as well, for those of you who aren't gamers and are listening to this, if you want a get in, I would recommend the film version of 2001: A Space Odyssey. Definitely, because again,
has its elements.
Well, it has a total removal of power that then becomes horrifying. But if you haven't seen it, I won't spoil it. So. Just saying.
I think it hasn't been out long enough for people to have caught it.
It's been not that long since it was originally released. I agree with you, Lydia.
I worked really hard to make sure I read that in the year 2000. And as basically a child went, eh? So my recommendation is going to be a bit generic, but it comes with an addendum, which is I recommend reading a random selection of Lovecraft, but with a very, very key consideration, which is, Lovecraft did a lot for cosmic horror and so on, but the guy was a really problematic author. Really, really problematic.
For his time as
and
well.
That's an important
thing.
For
his time. He was a bigot for his time.
It is easy to read his stuff and go, well, you know, it's the past. Like, no. Like, even at the time, he was an extremely problematic author. But what I would say is, if you choose to engage with it critically, and again, this is me, the soulless robot man who's always concerned with the how, but if you actually really dig into it and you want to wrap your head around horror, it's a good way for you to read it and go, I see what should have been different there, or I see how this could be problematic. And there's a very important aspect with horror that people forget, especially on the creation side, which is when you make something, you are telling people something. You are not just telling a story, you are telling someone everything, everything that you make has a message.
Yeah.
And sometimes that message can either be not what you thought, or can be the opposite.
Yeah.
If you want to tell a story about a strong female character in Bunny Ears, except at the end of it, all the audience thinks is, wow, that was a really flat, one-dimensional character. Congratulations, your message is almost certainly not what you hoped.
No.
And Lovecraft is a really great one to dig into, especially the Innsmouth Fish People one as one of the examples where it's like, interesting, I get the horror and I get why it's scary and there's bits I'd take, but it's a really good example of something that you can read and you can't just go, oh yes, that was brilliant, job done. You have to engage with it and you have to go, okay, if you were wanting to make something as horror as this, what bits do you leave behind? What bits are not appropriate? What bits do not fit our modern world? Mm. Or even, let's be frank, the world that he was writing in. But it's just, it's very easy to read passively and it's very easy to watch something and go, that was scary, therefore it was good. And it's like, ah.
I'm inclined to agree. Having very recently been introduced to the written version and the audio version of, I think it was, what's it, the Dunwich Horror?
Yes, the Dunwich Horror, yes.
Yeah, the Dunwich Horror. I recently heard the audio version of that, and having listened to it for the first time, I totally agree. Yeah, I totally... You can literally see the points where you can go, ah, right, yeah.
So I think we will wrap up there. Yes, we're going to have to put a reading list on this show.
Yeah,
so
we actually are.
We will put together a reading list so that it's things that we think that you should probably give a go. Apart from that, I think that we're done here. I think we've covered assistance. I think that we've covered...
Alex wants us out of his house.
Literally
I am tired. but no, thanks for both of you coming. And thanks so much for listening. And thanks for bearing with us over this season break. Mm-hmm. Next week, we should be returning to our previously scheduled programming.
Exciting times.
Yeah. I mean,
it's coming back.
I might just decide to hold off the cliffhanger for another 6 months just to see what happens. Who knows?
That's the true horror.
Yeah, that really is, yeah.
But
meta.
I think we'll wrap up there. So thanks from me and thanks from everyone else.
Bye.
Thanks everyone. Bye.
This episode is distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 international license. For more information, visit rustyquill.com, tweet us at @TheRustyQuill, visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi everyone, it's Helen here, the voice of Azu, Enola and Laverne. Today, I'm here to tell you about Woe Begone, a podcast launched on the RQ Network. Woe Begone is a weekly horror sci-fi audio drama series about the nature of power and the implications of linear time. Woe Begone follows Mike Walters, who discovers a mysterious and violent online game. What begins as an exploration of an alternate reality game with real-life consequences quickly becomes a search for the technology that makes the game possible. Each episode has a unique soundtrack composed by creator and writer Dylan Griggs. Listen to Woe Begone, spelled woe period begone, wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out woebegonepod.com for episodes and transcripts. Have fun and see you later.